Monday morning you showed the fight. Good morning, NFL fans. Welcome to another episode of Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. We have another exciting show for you today. Great action in Week 7 of the NFL. We want to make you part of the action here on the show. So tweet at me, DM HOLCOMB. Send me an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com. Or find me on Facebook, Dave's Football News. But we have plenty to discuss today. Big victory for the Kansas City Chiefs in the AFC West. Road victory over the San Diego Chargers. Dallas Cowboys win their sixth straight to be, or really take, the top spot in the entire NFC. And then in our fourth and long segment, we're going to talk the team that was the top team in the NFC coming into the season, the Super Bowl champs, Seattle Seahawks. Are they still a dominating team in the NFL after their loss to St. Louis? A Thursday night football controversy. Of course, it involves field goal attempt between the Jets and Patriots. Seems like those guys have a field goal controversy every year now. And we're talking, who is the team to beat in the AFC North? But we start out with Sunday night football. We see another blowout, but at least it's a memorable night because Peyton Manning set the new passing touchdown record, eclipsing Brett Favre's mark of 508 touchdown passes. Manning came into the game too short of the record, got two in the first quarter, and got the third one with a few minutes left in the first half, hitting Demaryius Thomas in the corner of the end zone for that record-setting touchdown, 509th passing touchdown in Manning's career. He added another one in the second half, so he has 510 in his career. He has a real shot of going all the way to 600. Tony Dungy made the remark after the game that he believes Manning will have 600 passing touchdowns when it's all said and done, as long as he wants to keep playing. It's not a question of can he produce at that high level. The question really just is, will Manning decide to keep playing? And all signs point to him continuing to play after this season. But that is a discussion for another day. As much as we can talk about Peyton Manning and his record-setting night, I don't want to take anything away, and I'm sure no one else wants to either, about the Denver Broncos really becoming the true dominating team in the NFL. You know, we mentioned it at the top in our headlines, Seattle Seahawks and the debate of whether they're still a dominating team. Their record is 3-3. Now, they beat the Broncos a few weeks ago. So the Seahawks, of course, could make an argument that they are still an elite team in this league. But week to week, game to game, we're almost halfway through the year. So we're really starting to get a sense of who are contenders and who are pretenders. The Broncos, surprise, surprise, are true contenders in the league this year. There's just a different feeling around this team than there was last year. I was not high on the Broncos last year at all. You know, they're a team that I thought could win the AFC because it was such a weak conference. And I felt the same way coming into this season, that in a weak AFC, the Broncos are going to be on top. But the way they're playing right now, Denver has a real argument to be number one in the entire league. And a clear cut, no debate. And they've been number one, at least the past week, in my power rankings, if you check those out on Football Nation. Those rankings coming out again on Tuesday, and I'll give you a hint right now, the Broncos are going to be number one again. This team, I just said, they have a different feel to them than a year ago. That's because they win with defense. Of course, they put up over 40 points again against an elite 49er defense. Peyton Manning throwing four touchdowns. Yeah, I get it. The offense is really good. But this team, they really start with their defense. Now, let me explain. The San Francisco 49ers are one of the best rushing teams in the league. At least that's what they're known for. That's what their bread and butter has been since Jim Harbaugh took over that team. Sunday night, San Francisco had 18 carries for 62 yards rushing. That's a 3.4 yards per carry average. Frank Gore, their leading rusher on the season, and the last 10 years, had 9 carries, 20 yards. With the offense clicking like it is, with Demaryius Thomas, Julius Thomas, Wes Welker got involved in the action with a touchdown. Emmanuel Sanders, although he's in the top 10 in the league in receiving yards and catches, he caught just his first touchdown on Sunday night. But he's getting involved in the red zone. With the offense clicking like it is, even without Monte Ball, they're still able to run the ball effectively. It is so difficult to try and beat this team without having a running game. The best way to beat the Broncos, the best way to stop Peyton Manning, is to have him not on the field. And the only way to do that is to control the clock, control the pace of the game with your running attack, which no team, not even really Seattle. Seattle really maybe the only team that's been able to do it so far. And it's probably no coincidence that that's the only Broncos loss. But there has been no team outside of the Seahawks that has been able to establish a running game against the Broncos. That has led to their success. If you can't run against the Broncos, then Peyton Manning is going to be on the field a lot, and he's going to do what he does best. And then when you get out to a 14-point lead early in a game like the Broncos did against the 49ers Sunday night, then you tee off your pass rushers. Then you wake up Von Miller, DeMarcus Ware, and they tee off on a team that has to throw the ball to try and catch up. 6 sacks on Colin Kaepernick Sunday night. For all those reasons, as impressive as Peyton Manning has been in his third year with the team and all his receiving weapons, it's the defense that'll take this team back to the Super Bowl. As for the 49ers, you know, I really thought they were going to compete in this game, even though they're beat up on their defense. No Patrick Willis in this game. Navarro Bowman's still not out there. They were missing quite a bit in the secondary and at the linebacker core. I still thought they were going to compete in this one, even on the road. Boy, was I wrong. They made a few big mistakes early on in this game, which just kind of led to the Broncos avalanche in the first quarter. And that's what Chris Collinsworth called it. And I think that's a perfect word for it. Kind of a play on words because the game's in Denver, Denver Avalanche, the name of their hockey team, actually. But it's so true. It's like 1-3 and out against the Broncos leads to Peyton Manning going down the field for a touchdown, and then all of a sudden you're behind and you're trying to catch up, throwing the ball, and that just snowballs into a giant Broncos lead, and that seems to be what happened on Sunday night. The 49ers, in their second offensive possession, went for a long field goal in the mile-high air. Phil Dawson not able to hit a 51-yard field goal. That, I think, was a big missed opportunity, even though it wasn't 3 points. It was a momentum shifter early on in the first quarter. And then on the next offensive possession, the 49ers, within striking distance, Colin Kaepernick on third and goal, hits Anquan Boldin, should have a catch, easy walk in into the end zone. Boldin drops the ball because he turns too quickly to try and get into the end zone to see if there's some defender that's going to hit him. Would have been an easy touchdown. That would have made the game 14-7. Would that have changed the ultimate outcome of this game? Probably not. But that is what led to what I call the avalanche of the first half. Rather than only a 7-point deficit, the 49ers were still down by 2 possessions because they had to settle for a field goal there. It was 14-3. Then to start the second half, the Broncos got the ball, but the 49ers defense came up with a big stop. They got they forced a punt from the Broncos. But then on the next possession for the 49ers, instead of making it a one-score game, 21-13 or 21-17 if they score a touchdown, Colin Kaepernick throws an interception. Credit Khalid Tlaib making a great defensive play for the Broncos. That's why they brought him in here, to make big plays and take some of the burden away from the Broncos' offense, which I just spent several minutes talking about why the Broncos are so much better, because the defense has been able to take away some of the burden from the Broncos' offense. But Kaepernick, in a game that he's trying to come back in for the 49ers, you can't make mistakes like that. Now, you already are behind the eight ball because of your mistakes in the first half. You actually did a great job of forcing a punt to start the second half. Maybe you can build some momentum on offense with a score, and you give the ball right back to Peyton Manning. Surprise, surprise, first play of the Broncos' next possession, 40-yard touchdown to Demaryius Thomas, and the game's over. That was it. That was all she wrote. I talked about when I mentioned the Broncos' defense stopping the 49ers' running attack. And in order to beat the Broncos, you really have to control the time of possession. The Broncos forced 4 3-and-outs on defense. So San Francisco on offense had 4 drives of 3 plays. That's not going to get it done. That's not helping you control the pace of the game and the time of possession to keep Peyton Manning off the field. There was another big game in the AFC West. Kansas City Chiefs getting as big of a victory, maybe a bigger victory, than the Broncos got on Sunday Night Football. The Chiefs defeating the Chargers 23-20 in San Diego. This game was really won in the third quarter. The Chiefs took over the game at that point, kept the Chargers off the field. That is something that the Chargers really try to do a lot, is keep the opposition's offense off the field. That's what I imagine they're going to try and do to Peyton Manning next week when they face each other on Thursday Night Football, which I'm really looking forward to. That's a first, right? We're looking forward to Thursday Night Football this week. But Kansas City really did an excellent job of keeping San Diego's offense off the field, especially in the third quarter. And that's really when this game shifted. The Chargers only had 3 plays on offense in the third quarter. The Chiefs' defense held San Diego to just 2 field goals in the second half, after it looked like Phillip Rivers was really going to go off and have a huge day in this one, like he's had in the previous 5 or 6 games. Rivers threw for 205 yards, completed 17 of his 31 passes, 2 touchdowns, both of them coming in the first half, though, and threw a late interception in the game. Alex Smith outplayed Phillip Rivers in this game, and that's one of the reasons why the Chiefs were able to get the narrow victory. Smith completed 19 of 28 passes, 221 yards, and a touchdown. Jamaal Charles also outgained his counterpart, Brandon Oliver. 22 carries for Charles, 95 yards, and a touchdown. Oliver, 15 carries, just 67 yards. So being able to keep the Chargers' offense off the field with their own offense was huge for the Kansas City Chiefs, but getting off the field by stopping the Chargers' rushing attack was also huge for the Chiefs in this game. I don't really know why. I'll have to go back and look at this game a little bit closer when I go back and watch it on NFL Game Rewind, but the Chargers had 16 rushes versus 31 passes. To me, that's not what's going to lead to success for them. I mentioned off the top, you know, they're a team that wants to run the ball and control the clock, and that's something that they're going to definitely have to do against Denver on Thursday. If they have twice as many passes as runs in the game against Denver, that is not a successful formula to beat Denver. this coming week. Honestly, it's not a successful formula for the Chargers to win any game. They want to get Brandon Oliver and their running attack involved. You know, they're a very stubborn team, which I think is good on offense. No matter how productive the running game is, they want to run the ball. And that leads to their success through the passing game. That is something they're going to have to do to beat Denver. I want to end this segment just briefly talking about the Kansas City Chiefs again. I know they're just 3-3. And they're in a very tough division with the Broncos and Chargers. They've played those two teams twice. They're 1-1 against them. Both of those games on the road. So they play them two more times, both at home, which is a huge advantage for Kansas City. I just want to say, don't sleep on the Kansas City Chiefs. The AFC, as I've said over and over on this show, a very weak conference. Not many elite teams in the entire conference. You know, we could talk about Indianapolis kind of coming into their own, and maybe you can consider them an elite team. San Diego, before this loss, a lot of people were really high on, and I'm still high on them. And of course, Denver, the best team in the league, in my opinion. Besides that, it's wide open. And of course, Kansas City, they're not going to win the division. That's going to be very difficult for them to do. They would really have to, they might have to win out to win the division. They'd have to beat Denver. They'd have to beat Kansas City at home. Those are, of course, advantages they're at home. But I think at this point, Kansas City would be happy going 1-1 again with those teams and splitting those series overall 2-2. And then hopefully for them, sweeping the Raiders. But they are a team, even if they don't win the AFC West, their team I wouldn't want to face in the second half of the year. They've been impressive in a lot of their games, and they've played hard in each of their games after the week one dud against the Titans. That's a game that ultimately might come back and bite them. That's a game that at home they really should have beat Tennessee, but got routed 26-10. But since then, they've been great. They had impressive wins over the Dolphins, the Patriots, and now looked pretty good against the Chargers. And their two losses since week one were on the road against the 49ers and the Broncos. So I really believe, again, it's tough to say if they're going to be a playoff team because they'll have to take a wild card spot. I don't think they're going to win the division, but they're a team that, again, I would not want to face, and a team that I have my eyes on for the second half of the season. All right, we're moving into our first break on the show. We're going to go to a song from The Who, and then we're going to come back. Giants-Cowboys facing off, NFC East showdown, Dallas winning their sixth straight. Welcome back to Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. We want to make you a part of the show. Tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB. Send me an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com. Find me on Facebook, Dave's Football News, or you can always leave a comment on the article page where this podcast is embedded on Football Nation. We're going into Giants-Cowboys, breaking down that one. Cowboys winning their sixth straight after their week one loss to the 49ers. They have taken over the top spot in the National Football Conference. We can send DeMarco Murray all the praises that we want, and we should. We do every week, it seems now. He has set a NFL record. He is the first running back in NFL history to rush for 100 yards in each of his first seven games. He is on pace for a 2,000-yard rushing season. He is on pace to finish third all-time in rushing yards in a single season. Incredible. Just an incredible run. And I bring this up every week. DeMarco Murray has never played a 16-game season. He has always missed at least two games in every year that he's played in the NFL. And I hope that for once he can stay healthy. But at some point, and every week until it happens, I'm probably going to bring it up that he's injury prone and he's going to at some point probably miss a game or two. So I don't want that to be the focus, though, of this segment. You know, the focus is the Cowboys winning this game 6-1 on top of the NFC East and the entire conference. And that real reason why they were able to beat the Giants on Sunday was Tony Romo. Yeah, I've alluded to this pretty much all year when talking about the Cowboys and really talking about DeMarco Murray and his dominance and the offensive line's dominance and really the resurgence of the Cowboys' defense. But what Tony Romo has been able to do this season should not go unnoticed, and especially what he was able to do Sunday. This was really the first time this year that it was Tony Romo leading the Cowboys to victory. You know, again, Murray went over 100 yards, and he scored a touchdown. And he has been the leader on offense. But Romo is still the quarterback. And you knew that there were going to be games where he had to not win them by himself. That's the whole point that I've tried to make through the first 7 weeks of the season, that Tony Romo no longer has to do it by himself. But that is what makes him more effective in the long run. DeMarco Murray, again, 28 carries, 128 yards, and a score. Dez Bryant is helping out Tony Romo, showcasing his playmaking ability. He had his best game statistically on Sunday, 9 catches, 154 yards. The defense forced 2 turnovers. The kicking game sealed the victory with Dan Bailey, and he's been solid all year long. But Romo, 17 of 23 passing, 279 yards, 3 touchdowns, and a pick. That is exactly what you want out of Tony Romo. And I apologize if I'm repeating myself from last week. I didn't get to go back and listen to my show from last week, so maybe I'm saying the same thing over again. But you know what? It's worth saying again, because this is really so important. This is exactly what the Cowboys should want, and I believe this is what Jason Garrett now wants from Tony Romo. He does not want him throwing 40 times in a game or 50 times in a game for 500 yards. And I'm thinking about that game last year where the Cowboys scored 50 points and lost to the Broncos. And everybody wanted to blame Tony Romo because he threw an interception on the last drive. Yet the only reason why the Cowboys were able to keep up with the Broncos and that great offense from Denver was because of Tony Romo. The defense did not help him at all in that game. DeMarco Murray probably didn't help him at all in that game. That was entirely Tony Romo. The Cowboys have a more complete team this year. They have pieces really in every part of the game to help them win. And Romo, if he can be that game manager, you know, that is such a dirty phrase in the NFL today. Oh, he's only a game manager. There's nothing wrong with being a game manager. A game manager can throw for 3 touchdowns in a game. You know, a game manager knows when to take chances down the field, when to push the ball upfield and try and score, and when to hand it off to the running back or when to just punt and let your defense win the game. That is what Tony Romo should be doing, and that is what he has been doing through the first 7 weeks of the season. In 2014, his passer rating is 100.5. He has 11 touchdowns versus 5 interceptions. And when you think 3 of those picks came in week 1, that is very impressive. So since week 1, during the 6-game winning streak for the Cowboys, Romo has 10 touchdowns versus just 2 interceptions. So say all you want, DeMarco Murray carrying the Cowboys offense. When you have a quarterback that throws 10 touchdowns versus 2 interceptions, I don't care how long the span is, when you have a 5-1 in touchdown-interception ratio, you're doing really well. Let's flip to the New York Giants here for a minute. In the last 2 weeks, we've seen them take on the top 2 teams, maybe in the whole conference, but definitely the top 2 teams in the NFC East, in the Cowboys and Eagles. And the Giants made it more of a game on Sunday in Dallas, but ultimately
fell short. My takeaway points from the Giants in week 7 was this is a good team, but it's not a great team, and they can't beat great teams. You know, and that's going to keep them from probably making the playoffs this year. That to me is the New York Giants. They were unable to beat the top two teams in the NFC East the last 2 weeks, like I mentioned. Their other two losses are to Detroit, who is 5-2 after their comeback victory over New Orleans in week 7, and Arizona, who's 5-1. So they're losing to really good competition and beating up on the teams they should beat, Houston, Washington, and Atlanta. But we all know that in order to make the playoffs, you got to beat some winning teams. And I have doubts going forward if the Giants can really beat a winning team, especially without Rashard Jennings, who they really seem to miss in their running game. But if you look at the Giants' schedule for the rest of the year, and let's start with the next 4 weeks. They have their bye this coming week, but their next 3 games are really important because those are all against tough opponents. You got Indianapolis coming into MetLife Stadium. Then you go out to Seattle. I'm counting that as a tough game still, counting that as a game against a winning opponent, even though Seattle at the moment is 3-3. And then you go back home to play the San Francisco 49ers. So you're looking at possibly 3 straight losses, which would end the season for the Giants. At 3-7, they would be out of the playoff race. They have to win, in my opinion, they have to win 2 of those games. They have to be 5-5 at that point to have a realistic shot at a wild card. Because at this point, they've already lost to the Eagles and the Cowboys. Neither one has a real edge in the division. But against either team, at this point, the Giants don't have the tiebreaker. So they have to really work out of that hole to try and win the division, but ultimately I think they're going to have to settle for a wild card spot. And when you look at the NFC as a whole, it's really tough to say that give the Giants a wild card spot when you have the two teams in the NFC East with just one loss. You have the Cardinals on top of the NFC West right now at 5-1. The Seahawks and 49ers both with 3 losses. And then you have the Lions and the Packers, both 5-2. So you could very easily, at this moment right now, the 49ers and Seahawks would both miss the playoffs. At this moment right now, the Lions win the NFC North, the Cowboys win the NFC East, and the Eagles and Packers are the 2 wildcard teams. I'm not saying that's going to end up being what happens come January. But can we really put the Giants ahead of the Packers, the Eagles, and then both teams out west? Can we really put the Giants ahead of the Seahawks and 49ers as teams that can come back and take one of those wild card spots? It's highly unlikely. The only scenario where I see the Giants making the playoffs is if one of the NFC East teams falls off, and the Giants would have to beat that NFC East team that falls off and overtakes them in the standings and takes that wildcard spot from them. Because I don't see 2 teams from the NFC East getting the wildcard. I don't see 3 teams from that division making the playoffs. Even if they're 5-5 at that point after playing Indianapolis, Seattle, and San Francisco, the remaining schedule for the Giants is Dallas at home, at Jacksonville, at Tennessee, Washington at home, at St. Louis, and then home against Philadelphia. If they're 5-5 in 4 weeks, they have very winnable games in the last stretch of the year. And then if they can steal one at home against Philly or Dallas, that puts them at 10-6. Possible, but also have to believe that they probably don't go 2-1 against Indy, Seattle, and San Francisco. All right, we're going to another song from The Who. Then we'll come back with our 4th and long segment discussing the Seattle Seahawks still being a dominating team, New York Jets and New England Patriots controversy from Thursday night, and who is the new team to beat in the AFC North. We got our folks together. We broke down barriers. We found a dream to dream. We were the carriers. We got rich and famous. Newspapers at our door. We talked a lot of crap. They just wanted more. We got a hit. Good news. We got a hit. We got a hit. Good news. We got a hit. We got a hit. Good news. We got a hit. We got a hit. Good news. We got a hit.
We're back on Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. Your host, Dave Holcomb. Tweet at me, DM, HOLCOMB, send me an email, holcombmdavid@gmail.com, or find me on Facebook, Dave's Football News. Played a little bit longer of the song there. Normally we only run maybe 10 or 15 seconds, 20 seconds max. A little bit more than 30 seconds on that last song, because I think it has a good message, you know, that we can send to the Seattle Seahawks. We broke down barriers. We came together. We got rich and famous. Well, by the way, that song from The Who's latest album, Endless Wire. Probably not one of the more well-known Who albums. It came out in 2006 on their last tour. But the reason why we're playing The Who today is The Who announced their 50th anniversary tour that's going to start next year, which I'm really excited about. Hoping to get some tickets for it to go see them in downtown Philly. But anyway, that's where the songs are from this week, but let's get into the Seattle Seahawks. And my statement to open up this segment, with the loss to the Rams on Sunday, we should stop considering the Seahawks a dominant NFL team. I'm going to grunt on that. You know, I've been a supporter of the Seahawks. I like the way they play. I like that they try to win with defense. They have a quarterback that manages the game. Just in the last segment, talking about how that's not a dirty word for me, a dirty phrase. You know, he's a guy that takes care of the ball and wins ball games, lets other players, other talented guys that are on his team, help him win games. He doesn't make it all about himself. That being said, you know, this is not the same team as it was a year ago. It's very clear now. It's funny because if you look back at the Seahawks schedule last year, they had some games where they struggled. They had some games where they barely won on the road, where they, you know, just barely beat the Texans. I think I brought up that last week, where they had to come back against Houston, who won just two games last year, on Monday Night Football last season against the Rams in St. Louis. They pulled out a victory on the last second drive, I think stopping the Rams. But the difference is they stopped them last year. This year, they weren't able to. They weren't able to get the ball back and get it into their hands of the offense, which is just a huge difference this year. If you look at the defense of the Seahawks, they've taken a huge step back from last year. They're ranked 19th in passing yards allowed, 252.2 per game. What happened to the Legion of Boom? A big part of that number, I believe, is the fact that they're not that stout against the running game anymore. You know, 82 yards per game allowed rushing. That's sixth in the league. That, to me, allows for more yards passing, because some teams, especially Dallas, but other teams, have been able to establish a running game against the Seahawks. The Chargers were able to do it. If you can run the ball, establish something up front against the Seahawks, make them commit a couple of extra defenders to stopping that running game, things open up in that passing attack. It's when Seattle shuts down your running game and you completely give up on it, that's where you're in trouble. But that hasn't happened in quite a bit against Seattle this year. The other thing that really jumps out at me for the Seahawks defense and why they're not elite anymore, they have just five takeaways this year. They're not getting the big plays. I mentioned that Houston Texan game. The reason why they won that game is because they got an interception late. Richard Sherman got an interception off of Matt Schaub, returned it for a touchdown to, I believe, either tie or win that game last year against the Texans. They're not getting takeaways this year. They're not scoring on defense. They're not putting their offense in better situations to score. They're putting more stress on the offense to do more things because the defense isn't making big plays. Speaking of big plays, they're not going to have Percy Harvin the rest of the year, trading him away for virtually nothing after they traded a first-round pick to the Vikings just a year ago for him. Was Harvin that big of a problem in the locker room? Getting into arguments with teammates or coaches that much, that often, that you gave away a player of the talent of Percy Harvin, a guy that was your top wide receiver on a team that really wants to repeat and is now looking at a position where they might not be in the playoffs? That says a lot about how much they just wanted to dump Percy Harvin. I know there were reports that came out on Sunday that they were shopping Harvin for Julius Thomas and Jordan Cameron. That's a joke. They would have never gotten Julius Thomas. Talk about aiming high and trying to get more than what you really deserve with a trade. Clearly, everybody was on to the fact that Harvin is somewhat of a locker room cancer because the Jets gave up nothing for him. But returning now to the Seahawks and the rest of the season, they're 3-3. By no means should they panic, but they really have come back to the pack with this loss on the road to the Rams. And it reaffirms that this is a completely different team on the road. You know, their success in the playoffs really hinges on their ability to play at home. And they are already behind the eight ball on that. You know, they are two games behind the Cardinals. They haven't played the Cardinals yet. They haven't played the 49ers yet. So they could still go 5-1 in the division. But last week, you know, my excuse for them was they haven't played any division games yet. They'll be fine. If they win majority of their division games, they are going to be in great shape to win the NFC West still. Well, that was assuming that they were going to sweep the Rams, which now they can't do. So now they're putting pressure on themselves to either sweep the Cardinals or 49ers or both in order to win the NFC West. Even if they win that division, they have three losses already. The Cowboys have one, and the Cowboys have the tiebreaker. So Dallas, over the last really half of the year, the Cowboys are going to have to lose three games. That's if the Seahawks don't lose any. That's if the Seahawks finish 13-3, Dallas would have to finish 12-4 or worse for the Seahawks to get home field advantage. And that's assuming Dallas wins the NFC East. Dallas could finish 12-4. Philadelphia could finish 14-2. Seattle could be 13-3, win the rest of their games. And Seattle doesn't get home field. Philadelphia does. So I'm not saying Seattle would lose definitely on the road in the playoffs, but they are a much better team at home. And as of right now, it is looking highly unlikely that they get that home field advantage that gives them that great advantage, probably the best home field advantage in the league. Well, we didn't talk about the controversy that happened at the end of the Seahawks and Rams game with the fumble, not fumble, the recovery by Richard Sherman that wasn't a recovery. I didn't want to spend much time on that because I think the focus really should be on the Seahawks and the fact that they're 3-3. We are, however, going to talk about a controversy that happened on Thursday night with the Jets and Patriots. On the last field goal of the game, the last play of the game, the Jets were attempting a 58-yard field goal to win. Down by two, the field goal would have won the game for the Jets. The umpire comes in and moves Patriots linebacker Dante Hightower away from the snapper and ultimately helped prevent a penalty that would have moved the field goal attempt closer. Now, there's no guarantee that Nick Folk would have made a 53-yard field goal, but that is a lot more, you know, realistic than a 58-yard field goal. So my statement The Jets and their fans have a legitimate beef with the referee helping out the Patriots avoiding a penalty. I'm actually going to punt this away. League spokesman Greg Aliolo told NJ.com and then went on NFL Network that this is actually a standard officiating procedure. Rule 9-1-3A states when Team A presents a punt, field goal, or try kick formation, a Team B player who is within 1 yard of the line of scrimmage must have his entire body outside the snapper's shoulder pads at the snap. So that is a rule that Hightower probably would have violated if not for the referee. But what the spokesman from the league said is the umpire, it's just standard procedure for him to step in and remind a player of the defense to not stand there. It's to help remind him of the player's safety. The flag would occur if the player does not listen to the referee. Now, this is what NJ.com and NFL Network reported. I still have questions about it, and I'm sure you listening to me talk about this, you have questions about it. My biggest question is, what if a referee forgets to remind him? Can the team then say, oh, it's the referee's fault. You were supposed to, you sometimes remind us not to do that, and then other times you don't. I mean, isn't that kind of arbitrary? I'm not suggesting a conspiracy theory here, but what if a referee is a longtime Patriots fan or something? Or is from Boston? What if we had a dirty referee and he, you know, reminded some teams to move and not get the penalty, and other teams he didn't? Again, I don't want to start a huge conspiracy theory here. That's complete speculation. I'm not saying there are dirty referees in the NFL, but it just kind of seems strange that a referee would be able to step in and kind of prevent a penalty. Shouldn't he be silent and not say anything? I'm punting this away because I believe the NFL and their spokesman in saying that it is standard officiating procedure, and I don't think it's in the Jets' best interest to really say that they lost this game just because of this play. The Jets did play a lot better than they have in the past this season on Thursday night against the Patriots. I really commend them for the fight that they came out with, but this is a 1-6 team. Now, this controversy is not ultimately hurting their playoff chances. That we have to keep in mind. Let's get real quickly to our last statement. Going to the AFC North, we have the Steelers playing Monday Night Football before this recording, but the Bengals and Browns both lost on Sunday in blowout fashion. Does that make the Ravens the team to beat in the AFC North? My statement, Baltimore is the team to beat in the AFC North. Look, it changes every single week, but right now I'm grunting on that. Before the season started, I don't remember if I had the Ravens winning this division or making it as a wild card. I think I had them winning the division. I'm not sure on that. But at this moment, I think they're the favorite. You know, they have been there before. They are a team that has won a championship recently. They know what it means to take care of business. They are not losing games to teams that they shouldn't lose to. No one else in this division can say that. You know, let's look at the Steelers, who haven't played in Week 7 yet, as of this recording. They're not contenders in my mind because they lose games at home to Tampa Bay and then get routed on the road against Cleveland, put up a lackluster offensive performance against Jacksonville, and got blown out already by Baltimore. That is not a team that should be favored to win the AFC North. And there's a very good chance that if you're listening to this on Tuesday or later this week, the Steelers are already 3-4. For Cincinnati and Cleveland, they're not teams that have a lot of success in just taking care of business. They are teams that annually and monthly lose games to teams that they shouldn't lose to. Cleveland should not have lost to Jacksonville. That, to me, is a team that on the road fell asleep after a big victory over a rival at home in the previous week. I wish I would have had the guts to take Jacksonville in my pick'em league. I thought about it. I really did. I also thought about taking Cleveland in my Survivor League. Luckily, I wised up and took Baltimore. I just had a feeling that this was going to be a trap game for Cleveland. And if you're a good team, if you want to prove that you're a contender, maybe you have some struggles in a trap game and it's close, but you ultimately win that trap game. Cleveland not only didn't win that trap game, they got blown out. They were embarrassed. Brian Hoyer, 16 of 41 passing for 214 yards. Let me repeat that. 16 completed passes in 41 pass attempts. That's awful. He averaged 4.5 yards per pass. You know, we were singing his praises last week against the Steelers because every pass he completed was for a big gain. And again, he had a horrible completion percentage. It was even worse this week, but didn't get any big plays. Ben Tate didn't get any big plays either. 16 carries for 36 yards. That's just embarrassing to get 36 yards on 16 carries against the Jaguars and average 4.5 yards per pass. The Bengals didn't fare any better, although they played a good team on the road in Indianapolis. Yeah, there's got to be concerns. Without A.J. Green, there was no offense for Cincinnati against the Colts. 135 yards of offense. They weren't able to get a running game going. And without the running game, Andy Dalton has proved that he is not a quarterback that can win games. He needs help. He needs the running game to be successful, especially with no A.J. Green. And all of a sudden, the Bengals' defense is terrible. They gave up 506 yards to the Colts on Sunday. I know the Colts are a good offense, but by God, 500 yards? Look, I probably took this part of the segment in a direction that I didn't necessarily want to emphasize. I ripped apart the other three teams in the AFC North rather than singing the praises of the Ravens. Baltimore does a lot of things well. You're going to get inconsistent play from Joe Flacco. That's a given. I really believe that's a given. Other people might argue that, but he's not an elite quarterback in the league. Some weeks he'll throw for 5 touchdowns. Other weeks he's going to throw 2 picks or 3 picks. This week he threw 2 picks, and the Ravens were still able to win by 3 scores, more than 3 scores. So, you know, kudos to the Ravens. They've gotten their running game under control with Justin Forsett. They have receivers to help out Flacco this year. Owen Daniels stepping into that tight end role without Dennis Pitta. The Ravens are the team to beat in the AFC North. One more song from the Endless Wire album of The Who. A song with the same title as the album. And then we'll come back and wrap up today's show. Welcome back to Football Nation's Monday Morning Huddle. I'm your host, Dave Holcomb. Don't forget to contact me. Find me on Twitter, DM, HOLCOMB, Facebook, Dave's Football News, or email me, holcombmdavid@gmail.com. 3 articles I suggest you check out on the website this week. Seth Carson's top 5 NFL coaches most likely to be fired. It's a good article. Don't agree with it at all. There are several coaches, maybe not several, but a handful on the list that I don't think will be fired. Mike Tomlin being one of them. Rex Ryan possibly being one of them. Mike Smith was also on the list. But the guy that I really don't think is going to be fired, especially after this week, although I'll give Carson a little bit of credit. The article was written before the games on Sunday, but Jeff Fisher's on the list. And Jeff Fisher and the Rams have played so hard for Jeff Fisher in his 3 years. I know that doesn't mean much to outsiders, but it should to an organization. You know, they haven't won many games, although they just did beat the defending champs. They play hard for Jeff Fisher, and that means something. You know, Fisher is a very good coach. Talk about that fake punt. At his own 18-yard line with less than 2 minutes to go, Jeff Fisher goes for a fake punt to get a first down so he doesn't have to give the ball back to the Seahawks. Goes for the victory. Talk about a coach that has nothing to lose. A team that has nothing to lose. Guys like playing for coaches that make moves like that. That put their jobs on the line with decisions like that. If that does not work, the Rams lose that game. And we are calling for Jeff Fisher's head in the media. But it worked. It was genius. I like the call even if it doesn't work. The Rams aren't ultimately going to go to the playoffs this year. You know, that's not a make or break game for them. That is something that really will help your locker room. And I love the fact that Fisher has given Austin Davis the keys to this offense. That is the best, maybe the best decision anybody has made this year. And maybe I'm overstating that a little bit. But it means so much to a young player when a head coach gives you confidence like that. When you go up to a young quarterback after just one or two games where he beat Tampa Bay and lost his other start, where you go up to him and say, hey man, this is your team. This is your season. You are my quarterback. So Austin Davis can settle into his role, doesn't have to look over his shoulder to see if he's going to stay in after every mistake he's made, and Jeff Fisher can get an honest evaluation if Austin Davis is the answer at quarterback going forward. Either way, check out Seth Carson's top five NFL coaches most likely to be fired. Two other ones to check out. Roger Emeka. His article called Dallas Cowboys vs. New York Giants, Three Things We Learned, and another one of the same series by David Levin, Miami Surprises Chicago, Three Things That We Learned. Don't forget, my buddy Tom Pollen will have his autopsy report on the top upset from the weekend coming out either Monday or Tuesday, and then I'll have my weekly power rankings come out Tuesday morning. Until next week, though, I'm going to go try and find some peace in my mind.